finishes off in style. A magnificent strike into the crowd. India lift the World Cup after 28 years.
Of MS Dhoni's helicopter shots, of Virat Kohli's screaming cover drive, of Rohit Sharma's effortless sixes, of Ravichandran Ashwin's carambol, of Ravindra Jadeja's chutzpah, of Jasprit Bumrah's once-in-a-lifetime brilliance. Hello, hello, and hello. Welcome to the brand new cricket podcast, Hotspot, where we will be discussing all things Indian cricket, whether it is about team selection or how the cricketers are faring on the field. To some topics off the field, we have got you covered. And as we go along in our journey, with your support, we hope to expand the topic of discussion to world cricket as well. First things first, we here are two cricket lovers. I am Chetan Narula, sports journalist and broadcaster, known on Twitter as the guy who doesn't like to talk about rain forecasts. But ask me anything else, and I am game to talk cricket. And with me, co-host of this podcast, is my friend and colleague, former Indian wicketkeeper and batsman, and now broadcaster, Deep Das Gupta. Say hello to our listeners, Deep.
Hello, Chetan, and hello, everyone out there. Well, it's a new platform, and looking forward to expressing our views, getting into conversations where maybe some of us might not get into.
For this first episode, we are obviously looking forward to the start of the 2019-20 test season. The T20 series kicked it off for us. But on this podcast, we'll be looking ahead to what is next for India in the World Test Championship, where India are placed, what is their test schedule like this season and over the next 2 years, and how this championship is going to work out.
And then driving straight into the preview of the first test, we talk about the big prospective strategic change, which is Rohit Sharma as an opener in Test cricket. Well, not just that, the playing 11, the composition and a lot more.
We will also talk about Rishabh Pant and what is ailing him at present. Is he still India's number one Test wicketkeeper, while also taking stock of the situation with Riddhiman Saha?
We'll talk about South Africa, how they're rebuilding their side after the World Cup. And in the absence of Hashim Amla, we will invite well-known journalist and broadcaster Neil Manthorpe for his wisdom on all matters related to Proteus cricket.
And last but not the least, we will take a look at possible selection for the first test and the big question mark, who are India's top two spinners at the moment. Will they play Ashwin and Jadeja? Will it be Kuldeep Yadav coming into the picture? Or will Virat Kohli play all three of them? So, Deep, are you ready?
Absolutely. I got strapped on, mate.
So just straight away, let us dive in to this first episode of Hotspot. Right, our first topic of the day is the World Test Championship. Barring South Africa, Pakistan and Bangladesh, everyone else has already started their round of matches. Of course, only the top nine teams are counting in this World Test Championship, the first World Test Championship with a final in 2021. In terms of points, it's a little weird, Deep. You know, you look at matches in a series, two matches, three matches, four matches and five matches. You have 60, 40, 30 and 24 points for a win. My first question to you, Deep, as a former cricketer, what do you make of this point system? Is it something that will excite today's test cricketers? Yes, every test match. Yes, different points, depending on the number of matches in the series. Different points, but every test match has something going for it now.
Absolutely. I mean, listen, off late there have been quite a few inconsequential test series, bilateral test series, but now every game there is a context to it. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect, but there is something to start with, right? So obviously, I'm sure ICC will go back and reassess this whole process and you know the point system and everything else, because fact of the matter is recently we've seen Bangladesh was beaten by Afghanistan at home, so, and Afghanistan is not part of the World Test Championship. So obviously they will revisit the whole process again. But having said that, let's go back to the point system that you mentioned. Again, listen, it's not perfect, but having said that, 120 points per series, because obviously the number of test matches end of 2021, end of the cycle, might not be the same, but the number of series are same. So it's going to be three away series, three home series for all the teams. So the number of series is fixed. And that's the reason the point system is based on series and not test matches. Because, for example, Ashes, traditionally, and it's always going to be a five test match series, and not too many teams would like to play a five test match series. More often than not, it'll be three or two or something like that, somewhere in between. But I guess that was the way to go about, you know, in the beginning.
Right. So let's take a look at the points table as of now. You have India top of the table, 120 points after the West Indies series. You know, in terms of this, you look at New Zealand, who have 60 points after the two-match series in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka, again, also have 60 points. In a way, it balances out because the teams are playing equal number of, not equal number of matches, like you said, equal number of test series in a cycle. And at the same time, you also have that opportunity. I mean, if New Zealand had won that series in Sri Lanka, they would have had 120 points, same as India. Or Sri Lanka, which are not the best test side or not the best cricketing side at the moment, they're struggling to find the right combination, struggling to find... They're going through a very tough transition period. So if they had beaten New Zealand at home, and at home they're a really strong side, they would have been on top with 120 points. So it is, in a way, playing out over a course of time, and giving
it should balance out. Should balance out sooner or later, because obviously not all test series that Australia and England play will be five test series.
Yes.
And in between, India will play a four test series or even five test series for that matter. So I think we'll figure this out at the end of the cycle. I mean, how good is this point system, whether it's going to work or not. But we'll figure it out when we reach the bridge, actually.
Yes, and I think what you said here is actually a very valid point, because I did this calculation for India, Australia and England, which are the three primary sides at the moment. And till 2021, India are playing 18 tests, Australia are playing 19 tests, England are playing 24 tests. So it's difference in the number of tests they are playing, but...
And you know what? Indirectly, Chetan, if you also look at it, it is also encouraging the teams to play more test matches.
Absolutely, it is, because they are all of them. They are contending for 720 points, like you had said, six test series, 120 points each. But it's the differentiation of tests. India are playing three series here, which are two match series, so they have 60 points for those series, right? And they are only playing one series, which is five test matches, so 24 points there. Look at Australia, what they are doing. Their home season, which is starting this year. You have two tests against Pakistan. You have three tests against Australia. Three tests against New Zealand. Then another three against South Africa. It's balancing out. They're playing shorter series at home, so perhaps that could be an advantage because you have more points for the shorter series. Similarly, for England, they're playing 11 tests away, five against India at the real end in 2021. But those five test matches which are away in India, they only have 24 points each. So you're losing less points away from home. And against West Indies and Pakistan, you're playing at home 30 points, 60 points, 60 points, two test series, short series there. So that's something really interesting.
That is. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, we'll only figure out the pros and cons once the cycle is over, the first cycle of the World Test Championship is over. You will revisit the whole process, actually, and I'm sure they'll make changes accordingly.
Absolutely. I think this point system is not really set in stone. I mean, you look at the you look at the ODI World Cup and they say, okay, the next two editions, 10 teams only, that is set in stone. We had a, never mind the rain, but we did have an interesting interesting league stage of the recent World Cup, and it finished in a very thrilling manner. But yeah, it's not set in stone, this point system. And hopefully it'll have much more evolution to it, like you mentioned, Deem. I mean, Afghanistan. Yep. How long can you keep them away from this Test Championship?
Yeah, because honestly speaking, as far as I'm concerned, there should be a two-tier test circuit, right?
Yes, so that's interesting.
Because you know, the top five teams, I wouldn't say six teams, top five teams can compete with each other and be good competition. I mean, India, Pakistan, South Africa, Australia, England, and then you have the other seven teams. And if you include Zimbabwe, that is, they are almost the same. You can't really differentiate between them. I mean, the test match between Afghanistan and Bangladesh was a good indication of that. So I honestly believe maybe
Let's not forget Ireland also. They are also a test playing nation.
Exactly. So seven of them, apart from the top five. So you can actually think about it. And that would mean that teams like Bangladesh, Afghanistan, Ireland, they also get to play a lot of test match cricket. It's not just, you know, depending on the other guys to kind of, give a couple of test matches a year in charity kind of a thing. You're part of the FPP.
Yes.
But anyways, I think we've got enough time sometime to talk about it. That's for the program. Let's get back to this series.
Yes, India's two major series, of course, in this duration will be the tour of Australia for four tests, England's tour of India, five tests. But let's talk about this season. New Zealand away next year, two test matches. And currently, they'll be playing at home, which is three tests against South Africa, two tests against Bangladesh. So you're looking at, what, seven test matches in this season, home and away, which is a decent start for this World Test Championship for India. And I think it's important to mention here, Deep, that, you know, India's next overseas cycle, the last one just went by. That was the last year, right? The next one is on the horizon. You have six tests next year, two in New Zealand at the start of the year, four in Australia at the end of the year. And then as soon as 21 comes around, you have five tests in England in the summer, which will be the next test cycle. But then you also have three tests in South Africa. So you're looking at 14 overseas tests in 2020 and 2021. Which brings us to the first topic of discussion in this podcast. That is the opening spot and Rohit Sharma as the new opener designate. Deep, it's an interesting one because for a while now, Rohit has been making a case for a firm footing in the test side. Every time he does well in limited overs cricket, there is so much debate and talk about him being included or giving a fair chance in the test side. Like, he's never been given a fair chance before, which is really weird. And this time it's happening because of the World Cup. It happened prior to the South Africa series or the South Africa tour last year. It happened prior to the Australia tour. And again, the same cycle after the World Cup. Now he's back and apparently in a new avatar. Before I get your first thoughts on this, we have to mention that in the two-day practice game against South Africa, board president's 11, which Rohit Sharma was captaining, he was out for a two-ball duck caught in the slip cordon of Vernon Philander. So not the best of starts for Rohit Sharma as a test opener. But first thoughts on this issue, Deep.
Well, my first thought is someone like Rohit Sharma, I mean, it's unfortunate, as you mentioned, it's been stop and start for him. But I think this could well be his last opportunity to make a mark for himself in test match cricket, because obviously middle order is packed as of now. And then, yes, I can understand, even though I don't completely agree with this move, but I can understand why Rohit has been tried out as a test opener because of his performances in the last so many years in white ball cricket. And his contribution to the success, India's success in white ball cricket. So I think at times you feel obliged to give someone like Rohit Sharma's credential, one more go at Red Ball Cricket, and that's the reason he's there. And like I said, I might not completely agree with it, or maybe the process, but you know what? I was one of the, I mean, I wouldn't say I wasn't one of the first, but this was also something that was going on in my head way back during the Australia series, where India was struggling with the openers, and I did mention it then. About how about Rohit Sharma opening the innings in Test match cricket when there was such a struggle as far as Indian openers were concerned?
Well, Rohit Sharma did not play that entire series in Australia. He went back to India for the birth of his daughter, had missed a Test match because of back issues as well. The big question for me here, Deep, is has there been enough planning for this move? Because let's be honest. Opening in Test cricket is not easy, especially, you know, you're looking at a time period or a phase in Test cricket where batsmen all over the world are struggling. You don't really see any openers especially doing well. India have been 10 for 1, 15 for 2 on their overseas tours. We'll come back to India's struggles, but just talking about Rohit, has there been enough planning for it? My first question, why was he not tried in the West Indies after KL Rahul failed in the first test? Because let's be honest, let's face it, Rahul has not been having the best of times as a test opener. He's been doing fairly well in the limited overs, whatever opportunities he's been given. Rohit Sharma could have played the India A tour against West Indies A and missed the limited overs leg of the West Indies tour because he was coming up immediately after the World Cup. Secondly, he could have also played against South Africa A, and he could have missed the T20 series against South Africa because, again, Rohit is a certainty to go to the 2020 T20 World Cup for India. It would have freed up a place at the top order, maybe given India a chance to experiment more, as well as given Rohit the opportunity to be ready for first-class cricket because the last time he played Ranji Trophy was in 2015. The last time he played Duleep Trophy was in 2016. He's been busy playing for India. There's been a lack of first-class cricket. Yes, some test cricket, but a lack of overall first-class cricket and nothing in the opener's role.
Yeah, and going by what I've read, I believe Ravi Shastri has mentioned in one of the interviews that he had mentioned to Rohit about opening in Red Ball Cricket way back in 2015-16. So if that was the case, and as you rightly mentioned, as his last Ranji Trophy game was against UP, what, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, yeah. Duleep Trophy 3 years ago, 2016 was his last domestic cricket long format, so I'm not too sure how this whole thing was planned, and I completely agree with you. Even if it was like planned 6 months ago, I think things could have been a little different how they panned out. As you mentioned, he could have played a few more games for India A in the last couple of months, foregoing white ball cricket, which he's a modern day great. I mean, he's one of the best white ball cricket that the world has. White ball cricket is not an area of concern as far as Rohit is concerned. Yes, he still needs to establish himself in the longer format. And that's where I think he needs to focus temporarily, at least for the next month or couple of months here.
I remember the World Cup game against South Africa. I was doing radio commentary with Sir Clive Loyon, and Rohit Sharma struck a beautiful 100 there. I mean, he was opening. Of course, the conditions, if you remember, in that Southampton game, they were not easy, despite the fact that South Africa had been dismissed for a low total. And Rohit didn't play his natural game there. You know, he waited and waited and, you know, waited. Bided his time really to play his shots. It was almost like opening in a test match. The conditions were so tough for batting. The ball wasn't really coming onto the bat. And you had Kagiso Rabada and, well, South Africa were missing their regular pacers, but Chris Morris and Kagiso Rabada were making, or Andy Lepeklekwayo as well, they were making it difficult for the Indian batsmen. And Rohit played an absolutely beautiful innings, scored 100. And Sir Clive Loyon, with me on the commentary, he was surprised seeing that innings, then why doesn't Rohit have a better test record? We'll come back to his particular test record. But again, like you mentioned, the issue here is the long-term plan. Because when you're considering the next overseas cycle, Deep, you are sort of shortchanging the opening position. Because let us take a look first what India have done in the last 2 years. They've used 7 opening partnerships. Okay, the best of them was Rahul and Shaw at home. And at home is actually the basic underlying point here. But then you have Dhawan and Vijay, that's over. Dhawan and Rahul, that's over because Dhawan is totally out of it. Then you have Mayank Agarwal and Hanuma Vihari, which was a stopgap. They averaged 34 in that one-off test match. Agarwal and Rahul, they've had 5 test innings, but their average is 17. So again, Rahul goes back to domestic cricket. So Rahul, Vijay, Dhawan, Parthiv Patel also opened in the Johannesburg test. They have all been discarded. Hanuma Vihari, he was a stopgap arrangement, which leaves you Prithvi Shaw, who's banned till November. Although I'm told that the Indian team management is quite keen for him to come back, start playing. And if he does well, they want to take him to New Zealand as well. And we'll come back to that point once more later on. But then that leaves you Mayank Agarwal. And now you have other contenders, Abhimanyu Iswaran and Priyank Panchal. You're familiar with both of them. They've scored a mountain of runs in Ranji and Duleep Trophy. So what do you tell them? What do you tell KL Rahul when you are giving Rohit Sharma a chance to open in Test cricket?
It's a difficult call. And I've mentioned this before. I really feel for these guys, because especially Abhimanyu Iswaran and Panchal, because these guys, they've been performing at the domestic level for the last 3-4 years now. And at every possible opportunity, be it Duleep Trophy, be it India A, be it Ranji Trophy for their state sides. So these two have been phenomenal and prolific in the last few years. So there are a lot of options. That's the reason why I think I said I don't completely agree with this whole idea of Rohit opening the innings and also looking. I mean, up to a certain extent, I think it could be a little myopic, Rohit as an opener in Test cricket, because as you mentioned, I mean, the next 5 Test matches are at home against South Africa and Bangladesh. But then what happens after that? And you mentioned right at the top about Sir Clive Lloyd saying that. Does Rohit have the basic technique and the potential? Yes, he does. There's no two ways about it. He has that potential and we know it for the last 12 years. The frustrating part is that potential has not converted into performances, especially in Test match cricket. But again, does he have it? Yes, he does. Does he want to do it? That's the big question, because obviously, success in Test match cricket would mean a little bit of adjustment as far as his technique is concerned, his mentality is concerned. Is he going to risk it at the cost of maybe losing out of on some white ball cricket, or losing out on maybe form in white ball cricket? I mean, so I'm not too sure whether he's ready to make those sacrifices, ready to make those changes at this point in time in his career. A lot of people have compared him to Virendra Sehwag, but yes, there is a fundamental difference in Virendra Sehwag opening from middle order and Rohit Sharma, to name a few of them. Virendra Sehwag was 24-25, not an established player when he was asked to open. Rohit Sharma is a very, very well-established white ball cricketer.
And so 32 years old.
And 32 years.
On the wrong side of 30, let's just say,
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy for an established player who's had such a great run in white ball cricket to make those changes. Then, Virendra Sehwag was predominantly a back foot player. Rohit Sharma is predominantly a front foot player, and we all know at that level, a Test match cricket at the international level, you got to have a good back foot play. Thirdly, Virendra Sehwag, when he was asked to open, he had scored a few hundreds, or rather 100, batting in the middle order in South Africa. Played the second new ball, you could see that he's got something in him which would tell you and encourage you to make him open. Rohit Sharma, he averages, I think, 22-23 outside the country in Australia and England, batting at number 5 and 6. So fundamentally, there are a lot of differences. So it'll be very unfair, and I find it very unfair when people start comparing him and Viru's situation.
Well, the overall overseas test average for Rohit Sharma is 26.32. And yes, like you underline, that has come batting in the middle order, when half of the time the shine of the ball has been taken off and you don't really have to contend with new ball as much. There have been times when his temperament has come into, you know, question. I remember the Southampton test back in 2014. India were approaching the tea session. They were up against it. You know, they had lost their top order. England had put up 500 plus. And, you know, just before tea time, he went and, you know, tried to hit Moeen Ali out of the park and was caught.
This is where your experience of playing or habit of playing days cricket comes handy. You just can't land up one day and start playing a test match irrespective of how good you are. Because these things, the one percenters as we call it in cricket, that comes from doing things over and over again, even though it might sound monotonous. But something like you mentioned, you know, when to play what kind of a shot. I mean, in one day cricket or T20 cricket, you follow your instincts. You follow what your mind tells you, what your body tells you. But at times in test match cricket, you just got to be careful in the timing of and the situation.
Well, again, there's another instance to compare here, because you go back to the Adelaide test against Australia last year. I mean, India had lost a few wickets again, and Rohit Sharma was batting at number six. He had got a start. He tried to hit a six. And, you know, the fielder almost pushed the ball over the boundary. And the very next ball, he hit Nathan Lyon up in the air once again. And the same fielder came into play at square leg and he was caught. So it was almost, I don't want to call it stupid, but at that point, that shot did not make sense. And now, you know, there are people who will favor Rohit Sharma opening in test cricket, and they say, okay, let's say Virendra Sehwag, because the comparison is with him, Virendra Sehwag has done that too. He would go after a bowler, and even if the shot doesn't come off the first time, the very next ball, he would go after that bowler again. But for all said and done, Virendra Sehwag did perform across formats, and he had the temperament to succeed in test cricket. Like you mentioned, the difference in age, he was not settled. There were various issues there which perhaps go against Rohit Sharma in this situation. But it also says something about the team management here, Deep, because look at the backup opener in this situation. Apart from Rohit Sharma and Mayank Agarwal, there is not a full-time opener in that test squad. Who is there is Shubman Gill. Because you are looking at a particular type of batsman. Mayank Agarwal, once he gets settled, he likes to play his shots. The same is true for Prithvi Shaw as well. And then you have Shubman Gill, who's again batted in the top order in first-class cricket. Rohit Sharma, we know he's an attacking batsman once he gets set, especially in subcontinental conditions. So are India trying to change the way they bat in the top order in test cricket?
It seems that way, because when Shubman Gill was picked as the opener, I was a little surprised. Yes, I think he's, again, a very, very talented youngster. But is he a test opener? I don't know. I mean, for me, I would prefer someone like Abhimanyu Iswaran and Priyank Panchal before Shubman Gill. But as you mentioned, it's quite obvious what kind of opener is this team management looking for. I mean, Rohit, as you mentioned, then Shubman Gill, who's a little free-flowing, you know, plays his shots and can go after the bowler very early in the innings. So I think that's the kind of opener that I think team management is looking for. And also the fact that Shubman Gill has played IPL. Right. Yeah. He's played, he's been part of the Indian squad. I think that also makes a huge difference, because when you have, you know, two or three players of very similar performances in domestic cricket, at times the selectors ask the coach or the team management, as in, you know, we've got these three players or two players, who do you want? And generally what happens is, because of familiarity, the team management would want somebody that they know of. They've seen. So I think Shubman Gill gets a nod here because of the fact that the Virat has seen him, the world has seen him, Ravi has seen him. Unfortunately, someone like Priyank Panchal and Abhimanyu Iswaran, they don't play IPL. I don't know why. I mean, we can do another program based on that. But yes. But these two, they don't. And not too many people know about their ability. Very few people know. People who follow domestic cricket, they would know about it, but predominantly people have not seen them bat. So I think that makes a huge difference. And quickly going back to the Rohit issue one more time. Listen, I mean, if anyone can make this happen. It's Rohit, because he's done it before. Rohit, mind you, was, again, a middle-order batsman in white ball cricket as well. I'm sure he's going to look back at that Champions Trophy 2013, where he was in a very, very similar kind of a situation. Everyone was talking about, you know what, it's time to give him a break. This could be his last opportunity. And he made good of that opportunity in Champions Trophy 2013. He's never looked back in white ball cricket as an opener. So I think he's going to look back at that experience and going to get confidence out of it and can make things happen. I mean, listen, he's got the experience. He's got the potential. There are these one percenters, as I was mentioning, if he's eager to make this happen and be successful in red ball cricket, I think he can do it. But question is he ready to sacrifice a few things that he might need for red ball cricket?
Well, the last point from my side in this conversation is that, you know, you have to look at what India are trying to do, not just in terms of their top order, but also in terms of their opening partnerships, because they've used 6 different opening partnerships in 14 overseas tests since January 2018 across South Africa, England, Australia, and West Indies. A majority of those openers, like I had mentioned, have been discarded, and they're now looking to re-establish their opening partnership. Going about it in a different way. However, like at the top of the show, we had mentioned India play quite a lot of overseas test cricket in 2020 and 2021. So there may be a case of India, while they are searching for a different type of opening test batsman, they might be playing with fire here.
Yes, they are. I reckon they are. Because also, to be fair to the openers, if you look at the record of the openers across the world, I don't see too many openers scoring very many runs in the last year, couple of years. The only opener comes to my mind is Karuna Ratne from Sri Lanka, and predominantly because he had a phenomenal series against, I think, South Africa. It was at home. But apart from that, I don't see too many openers scoring runs in the last couple of years. So, yeah, I mean, we got to keep that in mind. We also got to keep what's happening and put these performances of our openers in the right context as well. So from that perspective, I think it's also important to give the openers, whoever is playing, enough opportunity to settle down. And also at times, it's important to pick from the selection point of view, on the basis of somebody's technique, not just about runs, not just about the quantum of runs, but about the gut feel of a selector in terms of this guy being successful at a higher level or not, with what the kind of cricket and the temperament that he's shown at this level. And that's where I think selectors are very, very important in kind of assessing the temperament and also kind of the technique that a player possesses, whether that's going to be successful or not.
Right. So it's been a long time since Chiteshwar Pujara has been coming in at 10-for-1, Virat Kohli coming in at 15-for-2. Let's see how, you know, Rohit Sharma goes about changing things. Maybe he'll give new solutions. Maybe he'll help that Indian middle order, because there's one batsman in the Indian middle order who needs help, Deep, and that is Rishabh Pant. I mean, well, he's just a young kid on the block, isn't he? Or is he not that anymore? Either way, he looks in a bit of trouble and looks like he needs a bit of help.
He does. He absolutely does. There's no two ways about it. And I think it's time, what I call, to show some tough love. You know, I have kids. I love them to bits. But when they go wrong or they do something wrong, I also need to kind of scold them from time to time. I think it's, and that doesn't mean I don't love them anymore. I think it's the same thing, how I think Rishabh needs to be treated at this point in time. He still, I believe, is the future, as far as I'm concerned. But at this point in time, he needs a break from international cricket. And mind you, I mean, the domestic season has started. It's just started. We've got 4-5 months of domestic cricket of all three formats, where he can actually go back, get his mojo back, work on his batting, work on his keeping, and then come back as a better player. I mean, it's not that, you know, top batsmen or top players haven't been dropped before. Virat Kohli was dropped. Rohit Sharma was dropped. If you go back a few years, Rahul Dravid, Saurav Ganguly, name it, people were dropped and they came back as better players.
I think barring Sachin Tendulkar, everybody has been dropped at one point or another from this Indian side. You know, I agree to your point, but, and you know, even if you don't want to describe it as dropped, do you agree, first of all, that, okay, maybe Vridhiman Saha should play in this first test match? Because then it frees up Rishabh Pant. You can just say, okay, that we don't need Rishabh Pant. Now he can go back and maybe go back to the Vijay Hazare and play some domestic cricket. Because why, I'll tell you, it's not just about going and practicing or getting your batting right, getting your keeping right. It's also, at this juncture, I think, for Rishabh Pant, it's about getting his head right. Because a lot of people watch international cricket. They'll tune in for your T20 and your ODIs, and to an extent to your test matches as well, but not a lot of them will tune into your Vijay Hazare or to your Ranji Trophy. So with that pressure not there, everybody is not giving their opinions on Twitter every time he's going out to bat, or every time, you know, he misjudges during keeping. Not everybody will be watching or giving their opinion. So that pressure will be elevated. He needs that headspace because, yes, he's a young kid on the block, but this, it just seems there's just too much on his plate to handle, and he's struggling to find the right form or the right identity in terms of what he is trying to do or what the team perhaps expects him to do. Because, you know, you look at it, the last 10 T20s India have played, he's batted at number four in nine of them, and the runs aren't there. He has that one half century, has a 40 not out against New Zealand, but apart from that, it hasn't really worked for him. And you obviously translate into ODIs, and VVS Lakshman touched upon this, you know, that there is a lack of rotation of strike. He's becoming too much of a one-dimensional batsman at the moment in terms of perhaps a slogger, and you even compared to him, you know, compared him to Glenn Maxwell at one point.
Yeah, I mean, because how I see it is someone like Glenn Maxwell, he was a prisoner, it seems to me, he was a prisoner of his own image, the big show, right? He had to, every time he went out to bat, he had to prove that he's the big show. So at times, yeah, you spot on with that. I mean, his time away from the spotlight will give him some off time to think about his game, what his game is all about. And the good part is he can do all the roles, as you mentioned. He can play, he's got the first couple of gears, then he's got the middle gears, and he has obviously the overdrive as well. So he has all that, but he needs to figure out when to bring out which gear. I think that he needs to sort it out off focus, off the limelight, and staying away from international cricket will give him that. And also all these domestic matches. See, in international cricket, you're playing today and in a couple of days' time, you're playing another game, a high pressure game. So you don't have enough time to work on your game as such. But time away from international cricket will help him that way. And also talking about who will be my choice, it's pretty obvious, it's Vridhiman Saha. Let's not just talk about, you know, dropping Rishabh Pant. I mean, that's not the case. I think Riddhi, on his own merits, would find a place in that side. Because, mind you, Vridhiman was not dropped. He was injured in the first series against South Africa. And ever since, he has not played international cricket. But what he's done is, post his injury, his comeback has been fabulous. He's played three games of India A against South Africa A and West Indies A, where he's got 350s and he's averaging 66. And that's been the biggest criticism about Vridhiman Saha. He's the best wicketkeeper in the world. For me, he is the best wicketkeeper in the world. But the criticism has been about his batting. And that's what he's done ever since he's come back. His batting averages 66 in five innings. He's got, what, 198 odd runs. I was just checking that a while ago. And that's what you expect. I mean, he's delivered everything that you expect from him as far as batting or wicketkeeping. So, I mean, yes, Rishabh needs that break. But on the other hand, picking Vridhiman would also be the right choice, especially in the subcontinent where you need the wicketkeeper batsman predominantly for his keeping skills than his batting skills.
Well, it's an odd situation, really, because Indian team had a long-standing, you know, strategy of whenever an injured player comes back, he automatically regains his spot in the Test 11, which was surprising to see. Didn't happen in the West Indies with Vridhiman Saha, but now Pant has Saha to look back behind his shoulder. And also the fact that given the ODIs and T20s, how they are panning out for him at the moment, maybe he needs to look back at Sanju Samson, maybe Ishan Kishan. Yeah. And of course, MS Dhoni, who has, well, not really announced his retirement as yet. That's a topic for another day, though. We will be quickly moving on to the next segment of this podcast, where we'll be talking about the pitches and the test series coming up, the spin combination for India, the bowling combination for South Africa, as also we will have a first-time guest on our show. Well, now moving on to South Africa, and we invite noted journalist and broadcaster Neil Manthorpe, who's joining us all the way from Cape Town. It's a good time to start off for the World Test Championship for the Proteas in a bit of a rebuild mode, especially after a disappointing ODI World Cup this past summer in England, and their first outing in India with the T20 series. Yes, the first match was washed out. Nobody can control that, but still, 1-1. No, not many would have expected that. Welcome to the podcast hotspot, Neil, and your first reactions on the drawn T20 series.
I don't think it has any bearing on the test series at all, really. There's very, very few players who cross over in the two formats, but it was pleasing, and both pleasing and unexpected, to be honest. I thought that India would win the series and win it comfortably, and that was borne out by the result and the enormity of the result in the second game. But it was most unexpected when it was reversed in even greater style in the third game. But very, very pleasing. You know, South Africa have a history of using the T20 format as a way of introducing younger players and players to get their first taste of international cricket. So to actually beat India in India in one of those games was a terrific result.
Neil, can I just jump in here and ask you this? Isn't it kind of reassuring for South African system in what they're trying to do?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, everybody's now building towards the T20 World Cup, aren't they? I mean, we're still a long way out. I think a lot can happen in 13 months for 13 or 14 months. But yes, there's no question. I mean, that it was an unexpected bonus to actually win a game and to win it as comprehensively as that.
Right. And we've have a bit of a situation in terms of your transition and your leadership. We'll come to Faf as we cross over to the test series. But first of all, we have the leadership of Quinton de Kock, who, well, he thought winning the IPL for Mumbai Indians was the greatest high point of his career, which was really surprising. But now you also have team director Enoch Nkwe. I hope I've got his pronunciation closer to right, if not exactly right. How do you see this transformation from Faf moving on to Quinton de Kock, and what do you see the role of this new team director? It's an interim role. It's not a permanent role, as from what I understand. But what influence is he here to oversee the transition in the short term, or what could be his greater influence here?
Well, very, very much a case of transition. But I must say, you know, Enoch Nkwe has earned some coaching stripes. And when I say some coaching stripes, I think he probably hasn't earned enough stripes to be in charge of the national team in the conventional way. But he was a very fine all-rounder himself, a career cut short by injury. Who knows what he may well have achieved on the field. But he then moved to the Netherlands. He coached there. He's had various coaching roles below full international level. He's not shy in coming forward. I mean, he very much believes in himself. And there's also a very strong Gauteng bias in the new dispensation in South African cricket. The chief executive is from the Gauteng Lions. So there's a strong he has a strong support system and many who believe in him and want him to develop and grow and stay in the role long term. But the director of cricket role is one that's not existed in South African cricket before. So we're all finding our way. You know, that all the coaching staff, the batting and the bowling and the fielding and the fitness staff, those positions have also been filled on an interim basis. So really, it is baby steps at this stage, and we're kind of finding our way. South African cricket is finding its way with a white cane at the moment. maybe not the best analogy for a cricketer, but we'll see how things shake down. I mean, you know, it's going to be very hard. I mean, Enoch Nkwe's and everybody is talking boldly, not overconfidently, but, you know, there's no point going to India, despite the result from 4 years ago. There's no point going to India and saying, yeah, well, we haven't got a hope. You know, you've got to try and be bold and confident, and that's what people are doing. But if they lose the Test Series 3-0 and as comprehensively as it was lost 4 years ago, then it's going to be very hard for everybody to settle down and justify positions on a long-term basis.
Right. And of course, with the T20 series gone, it was a, you know, pretty decent start, even if it was a surprising start or a happy surprising start in that sense. What does that reflect on the future of Faf du Plessis? I mean, he's already announced that 2020 T20 World Cup is the marker that he's looking at, really. Does that mean you have an ear for the transition period where somebody like a Quinton de Kock, or you also have Aidan Markram marked for future captaincy? These two are the youngsters that have been earmarked as future leaders for South African cricket.
Yeah, Quinton de Kock's a really, really interesting one. He's not in any way traditional captaincy material. He's an inspirational player, and I don't think that he would be captaincy material in any other format. It's an instinct kind of thing. He's played a lot of T20 cricket, and so it's an instinctive appointment on the basis of his instinct. I don't think that he would be I think it would be too much of a burden to be captain of the 50-over side, and he's certainly not Test match captaincy material. Aidan Markram, of course, is born and bred captaincy material in the far more traditional level. So I was fascinated by the Quinton de Kock appointment, to be honest, and surprised. I think if you trust someone who's played over 100 games, he's only 27 years old, he's played 150 T20 games, and although there is more and more time for traditional thinking in T20 cricket as it develops and strategies emerge all the time, new one, with Quinton de Kock, you just go with his gut feel and his instinct, and you just ride the wave and hope you come out of it okay. Aidan Markram, though, I think is far more the long-term captaincy prospect. However, don't forget that Themba Bavuma is the vice-captain of the Test squad, right. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if he was being in fact, I know that he is being lined up. If he makes runs in the next 12 months, not that we have very many Test matches, then I wouldn't be at all surprised if he is made the captain.
Right.
You know what? The first thing that comes to my mind, Neil, is the absence of some big names now, right? It's not a team of superstars anymore. Like Hashim Amla is not there. AB de Villiers is not there. How is that going to affect the team culture or the team itself, for that matter? Or even Dale Steyn's not around. And I'm talking about some big names missing.
That's right. Well, exactly. But Deep, as you know, inside a change room, sometimes... and I'm not saying that the size of a personality is necessarily overpowering, because you wouldn't say that Hashim Amla is overpowering in any way. There's nothing but good influences and positive influences from him. But nonetheless, anybody who's been in the change room for 12 years commands a kind of presence, and that can be intimidating. So in a sense, to lose, although it's devastating for the team and the quality of players, but to lose Dale Steyn, AB de Villiers and Hashim Amla, it does free up a little bit of space for expression. And again, I really want to emphasize, I'm not suggesting in any way that Steyn, de Villiers and Amla are overpowering personalities and characters, because they're not. But younger players suddenly look around and they go like, well, actually, I'm pretty close to being a senior player now. So it's going to be really interesting. I mean, we'll miss, you know, Dale has been missing really from Test cricket for 3 years, to be honest. Couple of comebacks, but, you know, he hasn't been a force in the Test team for 3 years. AB's been retired for a year and a half now. And Hashim didn't make runs, to be honest. I mean, he averaged 24 in his last 18 months in Test cricket. So So I think we'll miss their reputations, but not, dare I say, their performances over the last couple of years.
Is there a, would there be a sense of unity or a, I'm not saying, like you said, that, you know, they have positive influences on the South African dressing room. But, you know, when you have somebody of the superstar status of AB de Villiers or Dale Steyn or even Hashim Amla to a certain extent, now they have gone. Does that bring the dressing room closer that, look, we are just growing in these roles and we are going to perform perhaps a tad better because we are all in the same group as individuals and we are not superstars as yet?
Yeah, that's right. You're quite right. I think Faf du Plessis is one of the best captains South Africa have ever had. He commands massive, massive respect. And it'll be interesting to see how the administrators treat him. He was expecting to go as captain of the T20 side. So it was very unexpected. And it was a bit of a shot across the bows from the administrators after the dreadful performances and disappointment of the World Cup, the 50-over World Cup. So if the remaining senior players feel that Faf is being marginalised and eased out without much respect or dignity, then they could well react in a very negative way. And, you know, they support Faf du Plessis very much indeed. And so his exit will have to be very carefully managed. I do think that after the T20 World Cup, he will retire from all international cricket. But that's just over a year away. And a year is a long time in international cricket. A year is a long time in any cricket.
Neil, I would be really interested to know the playing 11, especially who's going to bat at number three now that Hashim's not there. You see someone like Thinus De Bruyn come in and batting at three, or what's your take on that?
Yeah, well, I've been saying for years and years that Faf ought to be batting at three, but he's not going to. Like Joe Root, he likes his number five, but I do think that Faf ought to be moving up. Thinus De Bruyn scored 100 in his last innings at number three. It was a long time ago against Sri Lanka.
In Colombo, that's important. Yeah.
Yeah, in Colombo, exactly. That's right. And it was second innings as well. So he'll definitely come in there. And then Zubair Hamza is he's 23, Cape Townian, and made a very good, strong impression in the couple of test matches that he's played. There's Themba Bavuma as well. But it depends on the pitch. And, you know, South Africa have got a long history going right back to 1993. Of picking lots of spinners in the squad and then bottling it and just playing one.
I'll come to the bowling composition in just a bit. In terms of, do you expect, Neil, that this is going to be a grinding batting lineup? You have Dean Elgar, we saw in the South Africa, when India were touring there. And Faf, obviously, I was really, astonished by the way he was batting in that series. And then he came out to say that, you know, my first 50 runs, I strike, you know, at 40 per 100 balls, and then as I bat deeper, I make sure that my strike rate goes down and down and not up. You know, in any format of the cricket, of the game right now, especially in ODIs and T20s, as batsmen get set, the strike rate actually goes up, and that's slowly starting to come into the longer format as well. But it was so refreshing to see how Faf described his batting plan, you know, that the longer I bat, the slower I bat, the more time I consume. Do you think South Africa's batting plan this series, you have Aidan Markram at the top, he had a very free-flowing 100 in the practice game against board president's 11, but with Markram up there, Elgar, Thinus De Bruyn, Faf there, Themba Bavuma, is this going to be a grinding batting lineup?
I think they've got the batting just about right, the balance between the anchors and the engines. it looks to me like Quinton de Kock would probably be batting at six in order to make way for the second spinner. And then you've got Kagiso Rabada, Lungi Ngidi. But as far as the batting composition is concerned, Aidan Markram, as you have just seen, and have known before that, is quite possible. They're quite capable of scoring freely. With no shots he doesn't have, he is also capable of grinding. And Quinton de Kock has got the extra gear. I don't think that any of the other batsmen do have an extra gear. I mean, I think they'll be restricted to gears 1 to 3 probably. And I don't see that they'll be. I'm guessing here, but it's an educated guess, having been to India 12 times on previous tours. I'm guessing there's not going to be too many hard airport runway type pitches which will encourage South African stroke play.
Well, we're just going to come to the pitch contention. Here I want to throw a question to you, Deep. You know, they have batting consultant Amol Mazumdar, tons and tons of experience on pitches which Neil described as not really flat pitches. How does Amol come into this equation? What do you think, Deep? What is going to be his impact on the South African psyche going into the series?
I think massive, because a couple of reasons. One, as Neil mentioned, apart from Markram and de Kock, most of them are accumulators, right?
Yeah.
And we've got this name, and anyone in India and cricketing circuit knows it's called Khadoos.
Yes.
And Mumbai cricketers, which Amol is known for their Khadoos brand of cricket, which is being gritty. Right? And that's what it's going to be. In India, the main problem for most of the overseas teams are, you know, they're not gritty enough at times. You know, they're not ready to spend time and get hit and you know, manage the spinners that well. So I think Amol brings in that brand of cricket, that kind of mentality. And to add to that, I think that the South African batting lineup has enough batsmen who are willing to do that. Their style of batting kind of is ideal for some that kind of cricket, that Khadoos brand of cricket, where they're ready to kind of, you know, grind their teeth and just hang in there. I think that's the kind of game that Amol was well known for. And I think that's the kind of cricket, brand of batting that is required for South Africa, or any team for that matter, to do well on the subcontinental tracks.
Right. So at this point in time, all three of us really agree that these are not going to be, you know, airport or flight decks or flat pitches, anything of that sort. Do you expect, Neil, that this is going to be something like 2015, rank turners, Deep? What do you think, one by one? Neil, first of all, what do you think?
I first of all, I'm fascinated to know what you two think, because I don't know. But I would guess that, and listen, we're over 2015 now, okay? We're over it. There's no more bitterness, there's no more rancor. Well, a little bit, maybe. But those pitches, in my mind, I mean, you know, apart from the second test in Bangalore, which of course was rained out.
Yes.
Otherwise, South Africa might have lost that four-match series 5-0 if that hadn't have been rained out. But the other pitches, I mean, obviously India were better equipped to excel on them, but they were a gamble. They weren't really even a calculated gamble, particularly in Nagpur. That was just an absolute gamble. And I'm hoping, I think, that because the Test Championship is on the line, and because Virat takes Test cricket so seriously, he will have an end goal in mind. In 2 years' time, he wants to play in the World Test Match Championship.
Right.
And I think that, to be honest, you know, the reason India gambled so much 4 years ago was they looked at that South African lineup, which had been number one, the number one team in the world for several years, you know, was undefeated on the road for 8 years, which was unprecedented in modern cricketing terms. And they thought, we actually going to have to do something ridiculous almost to beat these guys. And they were gamble pitches, weren't they? And I don't think that they'll be in the right mind. They'll look at this South African team and think, you know what, we should be able to beat them at home on whatever we prepare.
Absolutely. I think some of those pitches were really ridiculous, to be honest. I mean, you don't really need those sort of rank turners, but perhaps influenced by the batting lineup, South African batting lineup, what those rank turners do, or if they do play rank turners again this time, what does that do, Deep? I mean, it brings an equilibrium. If somebody like Keshav Maharaj, Senuran Muthuswamy, Dane Peat, you have Ashwin, Kuldeep Yadav, Rabindra Jadeja. Does that, you know, bring an equitable balance between two sets of spinners? Listen, Ashwin, Kuldeep and Jadeja can get the South African batsman out, but Keshav Maharaj, Muthuswamy and Dane Peat, they can attack the Indian batsman as well if you play rank turners.
Listen, I completely agree with both of you. It's going to be a gamble, but I agree with Neil for a different reason. I think India doesn't need ranked turners anymore, not because of anything else, but the fact that Indian batsmen themselves aren't equipped well enough to handle. I think Maharaj and Dan Peet are quality bowlers, right? India has its fair share of issues against off spinners. Dan Peet is a quality off spinner. Maharaj can turn the ball on a highway, right? So he's a quality bowler. So I'd be very, very surprised if I see ranked turners in this test series. I don't think India needs it. I think the South African side might, you know, I think, as you mentioned, it just nullifies the advantage that Indian spinners would have or Indian batsmen would have if you give them ranked turners. Because, I mean, as you mentioned, Ashwin and a Dan Peet becomes almost the same kind of bowler if you give them ranked turners, right? And so I think that that's going to be a huge gamble. And I think India should be should provide good Indian or subcontinental tracks, not really ranked turners. I think South Africa can surprise India. I mean, it's like, you know, you if you go to South Africa and you give Indians a green top, I mean, you nullify the advantage. So it's the same thing. If you give them a ranked turner, if you give South Africa a ranked turner here in India, then kind of nullifies your home advantage to a great extent, I believe.
Well, I remember the second test match in Centurion, and Fab du Plessis described it as more Mumbai than Centurion, really. Neil, what will be the composition of South Africa's bowling attack? Vernon Philander, do you reckon he will be playing with Lungi Ngidi, Kagiso Rabada available? And of course, you also have Henrik Noté, who is the new fast bowling, or you know, he provides another element of pace to that lineup.
He's quick. He's regularly mid 140s and can bowl up to 150. So it depends on Lungi Ngidi's fitness, whether they think that he can get through 5 days. Not that many test matches go 5 days these. But I think that what they will do is, in order to make sure they've got enough bowling, they'll play de Kock at six with the top five batsmen. With Faf du Plessis at number five. Number four is a choice between Zubair Hamza and Themba Bavuma. I presume Bavuma will play. He's the vice captain. So Markram Elgar at the top with Theunis de Bruyn at three. So that leaves de Kock coming in at six. He enjoys batting at seven in Test cricket. Not that he's, he just enjoys the prospect of being 300 for five. Who wouldn't? But he's also, you know, he's happy to take the responsibility coming in at six. But it means that Vernon Philander will bat at seven. And I think the reason he will play, his record on the subcontinent's not great, because he does need a little bit of grass and a little bit of moisture. You know, we all know Vernon Philander. He's got a magnificent strike rate, a fantastic career record. But it's not on the subcontinent. But he provides the control. He, I think, will be the man that Faf will be looking to bowl maidens. You know, if he can bowl 16 overs for 30 in a day, then it gives Faf that control. And a captain, if he's not taking wickets, he wants control. And that gives the opportunity to play the two spinners. I don't think that Mutasami will play. I think he's there as the reserve, the backup spinner. But as Deep says, Dan Peet has become better and better and better at domestic level. He was the only bowler to take 50 wickets. And, you know, a spinner in South Africa, the leading wicket taker, that hasn't happened for many, many years. And he can bat too. So I see him at eight, and Keshav Maharaj, whose test record is phenomenal. And, you know, he's only had a couple of test matches in Sri Lanka. They're the only test matches he's played on the subcontinent, and he took nine for against Sri Lanka. He bowled about 50 overs to get them. So look, I don't know whether Henrik Noté will play. It's between him and Lungi Ngidi. But yeah, it looks to me like South Africa will be a batsman short of the way they traditionally play with de Kock at six.
Well, we also have to contend with what India will go with in terms of their bowling composition, because Neil, and the last time India played Test cricket, they threw in a bit of a surprise. I remember my CricBuzz interview in February with Ravi Shastri. He said Kuldeep Yadav is the number one spinner overseas. then he doesn't play in West Indies, because that's the way Indian team management rolls now. And then you have Ravindra Jadeja as the lone spinner. Where does it leave Ravichandran Ashwin? Because you're looking at a spinner, 65 tests, and you have 342 wickets, 38 of those at home, and a sensational 234 out of 342 wickets at home. How do you not play a spinner like that? Or let me just redefine my question a bit. Can you even drop a spinner like that in a home series? Deep, first you.
Listen, it's going to be difficult, right? But a lot of things have happened in the last 6-8 months, as far as I know. And what I've heard is, there were certain issues back in England where there's injury. They're still kind of trying to figure out whether he's 100% fit or not, whether he should be playing. But having said that, he's part of the squad. It does not make sense dropping or not playing him. So even though Jadeja at this point in time, I would agree, is your number one spinner, you've got to play someone like Ashwin.
Big call, big call that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, I mean, this is how I look at it. Jadeja has been phenomenal as an all-rounder, right, for the last 6-8 months across all formats. And he is getting better as a bowler as well. And if there is any help on that surface, I mean, somebody like Jadeja who bowls at 90 Ks an hour and then gets the ball to turn, I mean, he plays, he'll be an unplayable bowler then. Okay, leave that aside. Second bowler for me would be Ashwin and not Kuldeep, because again, Kuldeep last 6 months hasn't been that great for him. Moreover, the team management, I think, has lost certain kind of confidence in him and not picking him in T20, even ODIs. So I don't know where Kuldeep stands at this point in time vis-a-vis the team management. So for me, it's going to be Jadeja and Ashwin.
Well, when last time Ashwin played Test cricket, that was in Adelaide last year against Australia. He bowled 80 overs in that Test match. And obviously, he was crocked after that following his fitness issues in England as well. So, like Deep said, maybe there's a bit of doubt over his fitness and whether he can last an entire Test series. Now, even at home, you can expect him to bowl 50 overs per Test match. So you're looking at 150 overs in 3 Tests. Can he bear the load? Neil, were you surprised that Ashwin didn't play in West Indies? And do you expect, or what sort of spin combination do you expect India to play? Or in fact, what would South Africa prefer to play?
That's exactly the point, Chetan. That's exactly the point. And I think that sometimes selectors make the mistake of not asking themselves, who would the opposition least want to face? Let's look at their top, and look at Ashwin's record against South Africa. In South Africa, it's extremely modest. Even yes. when groundsmen mess up, like they did at Centurion 4 years yes. ago, yes. he has to bowl a lot of overs to get wickets against South Africa. And if you speak to the South African batsman, which I have often, about Jadeja,
right?
What batsmen fear most is the unplayable ball, the one that you've got no chance against. And much as they admire Ashwin, and much as he is a brilliant, brilliant bowler, as you said, how many wickets you got? 260 wickets in 65 Test matches. Phenomenal cricketer, brilliant. Perhaps prone to overthink things occasionally, but he doesn't bowl the unplayable delivery. Whereas Jadeja, he's bowling at 95 k's an hour and gets bounce, and batsmen just dread that, turn and bounce, and at pace, you've just got no chance. If it's doing a bit, if it's turning on the third day, and you're facing Jadeja bowling those darts that turn and bounce, so the batsmen will back themselves to bat long periods against Ashwin more than they will in turning conditions against Jadeja. Yadav, I think that they would enjoy having him in the side, because although he will take wickets, he will always take wickets, but at least he'll provide some scoring opportunities as well.
Yeah.
Well, he does tend to drift away a bit and give a few extra runs. Let me remind our listeners and obviously our guests as well that you know, Jasprit Bumrah is missing from this test series. Very quickly, sometimes Virat Kohli just likes to go on the attack. The last time India played a home series last year against the West Indies, they had all three spinners. They had Ashwin, they had Jadeja, and they had Kuldeep Yadav. Perhaps they did not need all three spinners. Since then, Jasprit Bumrah has obviously come on to test cricket and made a name for himself. He is not going to be available for this series. Then you have Hanuma Vihari, who's at number six. There you have some extra element of batting and perhaps the extra element of off-spin as well. Deep, final question to you here in this discussion. Do you expect all three to play, or because of Hanuma Vihari being there, maybe Jadeja Kuldeep becomes your, or not yours, at least Virat Kohli's preferred combination?
Well, I think they should go with two spinners, and more so because you've got Hardik as your fifth bowler, but you've got to be a little careful with Hardik and his fitness issues. You don't want him to bowl too much. So from that perspective, you will pick up a couple of fast bowlers, which would be Ishant and Shami, I presume, as of now. And then Hardik becomes your fifth bowler and two spinners. I think that's the combination they'd go with. And you always have someone like
Hanuma Vihari. Hardik is not available
In
the series. So yeah, right. that is also an influence.
Yeah, sorry. So Hardik's not. So that's going to be a major concern. So yeah, that's going to be a major concern. Then it just opens up for three spinners. Yeah, why not then? Then three spinners and two fast bowlers.
Yeah. Then you can possibly even leave out Hanuma Vihari and Ashwin could become your all-rounder. No matter, he takes up a lot of overs perhaps. But then you play all three spinners. You play Ishan Sharma and you play Mohammad Shami. You would expect Jadeja and Ashwin to combine as a batsman, at least in home conditions. Well, the last order of business on this first episode of Hotspot is pre-series predictions. Neil, since you are our esteemed guest, what do you expect South Africa to do in this three test series? What is your prediction?
Is it still rainy season?
in some parts, maybe.
Oh, in Calcutta, it's pouring, mate.
Look, as much as I can make a case for South Africa causing an upset, I'm going 2-0 India. I'd love to say 2-1, but I'm assuming that the weather will intervene at some point. I think there'll be some moments, you know. I don't think that, you look at 4 years ago, it was very, very one-sided. There were very few moments where you thought South Africa's really in this. But I think there will be a couple of moments like that. But I think that India's experience will prevail. So I'm going 2-0 India.
Right. Deep, what do you think? Do you agree?
Yeah, I'd go with that as well. But you know what? I think a lot of people will be surprised with the way South Africa play in this series, because I don't think too many people are expecting too much from this side. But I just have a good feeling about this side. You know, it's underrated. Most of them are under the radar, most of the players. And I think they might just surprise a few people with their performances, but might not be enough, though.
Well, I'll just agree with both of you gentlemen as well. 2-0 for me for India, and perhaps because of the reason that I just want to do the first two tests and want to get out of going to Ranchi. Not that I don't like Ranchi, it's just that it's just been too much travel and cricket. As always, it's going to be an intriguing India-South Africa series. First of all, our thanks to Neil Manthorpe for being the first ever guest on our new brand new cricket podcast, that is Hotspot. And also thanks to Deep Das Gupta and our listeners for joining in. This will be an intriguing series, most of all for Rohit Sharma as opener, Ashwin's possible return to the 11, and South Africa's new era without Dale Steyn, Hashim Amla, AB de Villiers, all three of them missing. Intriguing how it will go. We will be back after the first test. Until then, goodbye from all of us here at Hotspot.
Bodhi finishes off in style. A magnificent strike into the crowd. India lift the World Cup after 28 years.